Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny.
This week, Peter Swanson on his latest novel, Rules for Perfect Murders.
Peter Swanson's novels include The Girl with a Clock for a Heart, nominated for an LA Times Book Award, The Kind Worth Killing, a Richard and Judy pick, and the iBookstore's Thriller of the Year in 2015, and most recently Before She Knew Him. His new book, Rules for Perfect Murders, which we're going to be talking about today, has been optioned for film by New Regency, with Ryan Reynolds attached to produce and star in it. Peter, welcome back to Little Atoms.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So tell us, first of all, how you would describe this new novel.
How would I describe it? So it's narrated by Malcolm Kershaw, who is a sort of introverted bookseller and previously a book blogger. And a few years earlier, he's made a list of, he's a crime fiction fanatic, so he's made a list of his 8 favorite murders in crime fiction history, the kind of perfect murders. And he's forgotten about this list. It's been a few years ago, and an FBI agent comes and knocks on his door one snowy morning in February in Boston, and informs him that she believes that someone is using that specific list to actually kill real people throughout New England. And that's just sort of the first chapter, so that's the premise of the book. But then as we move along, we sort of get to know the secretive past history of Malcolm's particular story.
And as you said, the book is set in its present-day New England,
yeah.
As are all your novels, and indeed Roberta James makes an appearance at one
point. She does, yes.
And I'm sure I seem to remember you saying that was supposed to be a trilogy before.
Yeah.
And more specifically, one of the real places I wanted to talk about, which you mentioned in the acknowledgements, is a place called Annie's Book Swap, which features very briefly, is mentioned by Malcolm as an important place in his past. So I guess that must mean it was an important place in your past too.
Yeah, so Annie's Book Swap, as far as I know, was a franchise opportunity that really boomed in the sort of 80s and 90s, where I think what they would do is, you know, you would say you wanted to do a used book business, and they would send you the sign, and they would send you the shelving or something. I mean, it was sort of franchised in that sense. So there were many of the Annie's Book Swaps, even though they each had a separate owner. And basically what they sold were cheap, what we call mass market paperbacks, you know, just for like a dollar each. And there was one quite close to me where I lived, in fact, cycling distance. And you know, I think at a certain age, and it's hard to pinpoint at this point exactly when it was, but I'm guessing around 12, 13 or something, I just started going down there and pulling out basically all the books that looked good. And to me, a good-looking book was something that looked, you know, suspenseful and quite adult and has a lurid cover type of thing. So I picked up, you know, Agatha Christie's there, but I also picked up all these sort of mid-century American thrillers like John D. MacDonald, Ed McBain, Alistair MacLean. I picked up all sorts of stuff. Spencer Books by Robert Parker, who was local. And that sort of began my sort of voracious phase of reading.
And then Old Devils, which is the bookstore that Malcolm part owns in the story. Does that have any sort of real antecedents?
It doesn't, except for the fact that, well, it's funny, Boston actually is currently a city without a mystery bookshop. And this is a fairly recent development, because for years we had Kate's Mystery Bookstore, which was actually quite famous. It was in Cambridge, and Kate was around, Kate Mattis was around forever and had this great collection of used books and new books, and the store was this sort of glorious mess. She was very good at, she loved to talk about books, and she'd read everything, but she wasn't organized. In fact, actually, Robert Parker, when he was alive, actually built the shelves in the store because he was a good carpenter. But anyway, Kate went out of business about 4 or 5 years ago, and since then there hasn't been a mystery bookstore. And I briefly had a fantasy about opening one myself, and actually talked to someone in the book business who said, well, you know, maybe you could do the money and I could do the day-to-day operations. And we briefly flirted with it and didn't happen.
And this is what happens in the story.
But this is what happens in the story. So it's sort of a fantasy of mine that, although this thing might happen, because it is a shame that Boston doesn't have a bookstore devoted to mystery novels. Most other big cities in the States have one, I think.
This must be a rents thing in Cambridge then, is it?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, absolutely. I mean, a lot of the small indie stores are going out of business in Cambridge. And I think actually Kate's would have been saved. I think people would have run in. She was really quite beloved. And I think people would have run in and saved it, except for the fact that I think she was tired of doing it and just the sheer volume of books, and she kind of wanted to call it quits. And I regret to this day that I didn't swoop in and buy her stock, because she had offered it up. But I don't, you know, maybe I don't regret it, because it would be sitting in a storage unit right now. And but it was a great stock, and I don't. Who knows where it is?
Malcolm Kershaw. Then let's talk a bit more about him. So his wife, his ex-wife, but he's a widow.
Yeah, right.
His dead wife Claire features heavily in the story eventually, and obviously we don't want to give too much away about where the story goes. But tell us some more about Malcolm's background, if you can.
Yeah, I mean, again, I said he's sort of an introvert, but he's had this one great love in his life, this sort of fiery romance, or at least from his end, with Claire Mallory, who he married, and then sort of 4 years or so prior to the story, has died in a car accident. And what I think is interesting about Malcolm, what I was kind of trying to get across with him, is the type of narrator he is. He tells you the bare bones of his story. In other words, he doesn't tell you the emotional side of the story. It's kind of like an iceberg. You see a tip of him telling you a story, and what he doesn't tell you is a sort of a lot of the stuff roiling on underneath. So actually, despite the fact that I think he seems quite calm and clear-headed, and he's someone, I think, who, after suffering this tragedy, just wants to get through the day and cause as little ruffles as possible. So he runs this bookstore. He doesn't have a lot of friends. He sort of goes about his business, eating his sort of simple dinner at night. But the more we learn about him, the more we realize how shook up he was by certain events in his life and how much he's hiding.
Well, indeed, yeah, what he's hiding, because Malcolm is, this book is partly based around these 8 perfect murders in these crime novels, and we're going to talk about those a little later on. But there is another very famous crime novel by Agatha Christie that I won't mention the title of, but that Malcolm does a number of times. Malcolm is the very definition of an unreliable narrator as well, isn't he?
Yeah, he is, absolutely. And I think he hints at that early on. And, you know, it's a fun motif to play with as a writer. So, I mean, some of it, it's how he reveals his information and the way the story is told that makes him quite unreliable. Although, in a weird way, I think he believes he is a truthful narrator, because eventually it all gets spelled out.
I wanted to talk also about Gwen Mulvey, who's the FBI agent that first alerts Malcolm. Now, Malcolm is the narrator of the story, and it's his story.
Yeah.
But she's the person that first alerts him to this list and to what's going on, and actually, for various reasons, sort of drops out of the story as it goes on. She's great, and she's a character I would really like to see again.
Oh, that's good to know. Yeah, I would... Yeah, I'd be interested in that. I mean, I think she does drop out of the story a bit. And it's funny, I mean, this story could have been told from her point of view, of course. She's, in fact, traditionally might have been, which is, you know, you can sort of see it. Like, she's an FBI agent. There's been a string of homicides across New England that seem to not be connected, yet all have a sort of Baroque quality to them. And she recognizes one of the murders as possibly being related to Agatha Christie's ABC murders. She recognizes another one that might be related to Double Indemnity. She somehow puts those books together and comes up with this list. So you could certainly see the story through her eyes, and then Malcolm would be the sort of slightly jittery, slightly suspicious-looking list writer. But of course, we don't get the story from her. We get it from Malcolm. Maybe, who knows? Maybe she'll reappear.
When we get into the second half, as I said, I want to go through some, if not all, eight of those novels that you've chosen and talk about what's interesting about each one. Before we do that, I guess what I wanted to ask was, you know, in putting this, how did you come by this list? How did you whittle it down? And what are some others that might not have made it? But to frame that, actually, I want to say, how would your list have been different to Malcolm's?
Yeah. I mean, it's actually very similar to Malcolm's in the sense that Malcolm, despite not being like me, actually has my reading history and my reading preferences. That's not always the case with my books. I think at one point I thought I was going to distinguish a little between Malcolm's taste and mine, and then I thought, just, you know, why do that? Why not just make him essentially autobiographical in that sense as a reader? Me as a reader and Malcolm as a reader. So certainly the eight books that he picks are all books that I love and all books that I think have a particularly clever murder. For the purposes of the book, I needed them to have a murder that was sort of replicable by the killer. So there were other reasons to pick them, and I did at varying points have... I had a longer list at one point. I had a different list at other points, and I had certain things. Like, ABC Murders is maybe not my favorite Agatha Christie, but it's one that made sense, you know, basically hiding a homicide within a... what looks like a serial killer, which is kind of the theme of that book, seemed like something that someone could replicate.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Listening to Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Peter Swanson. We're talking about his latest novel, Rules for Perfect Murders. And Peter, as I said, I want to go into the list of of the eight novels. Yeah, just scanning again, I've only read one of these.
Okay.
And perhaps that'll come up as we get further down the list.
So I feel a little bad because, of course, I spoiled a bunch of them for you. But I mean, and you were required to read the book because, you know, you're doing this podcast. I mean, my argument for the people, I think, who... there is an Agatha Christie book that's slightly spoiled. And I think my argument would be, you know, if you're a crime fiction fan and you're reading my book and you haven't yet read this particular Agatha Christie book, then maybe your priorities... be a little straightened out. And there are some spoilers for these books. There kind of had to be. There had to be for the purposes of this story.
And most of them are old. And in fact, let's talk about the ABC Murders first of all, because there was very recently a really good television adaptation of it in the UK. I don't know if it got over to the US, so people may be more familiar with this one than you might think. Why this one?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, in all honesty, a number of these books were books that I sort of thought were very clever for a very long time, and I've always been a little mesmerized by this particular murder plot, which is, and again, these are some sort of slight spoilers that I'll be discussing. It doesn't necessarily give away the end of the book or what happens, but it gives away maybe the middle, which is what they kind of discover is that there's a series of murders happening that that seem to be related by letters. So it's like Anthony Adams in Andover dies, and then Beatrice Bernadetti from Brighton dies. So it looks like this sort of mad serial killer is killing off people based on, at the time, the postal book. He's going through the post book and finding these people to kill randomly. So it looks like a random serial killer, when in fact it's disguising a singular victim. I always thought that was brilliant. I also think it's just sort of horrific in the sense that, like, you want to kill one person, and the best way to do it is just kill a bunch of other people in the same way and make it look like a serial killer. I mean, it seems very clever, and it seems like the type of idea that would actually work and you'd get away with. So again, it's that type of thing I was thinking about, something doable. As opposed to, I mean, maybe my favorite Christie novel is And Then There Were None, which has 10 victims on an island, and that, you know, I wasn't going to have the killer in this actually try and contrive to get 10 people onto an island and kill them all.
What we didn't say before we dived into the first one is, let's talk about the very concept of the perfect murder. You know, George Orwell famously wrote an essay about, the perfect English murder. But we're talking about something different here, I think. So how do you define...
What's funny is...
Or how does Malcolm define it?
Yeah. I mean, what's funny about it is none of these actually are perfect murders because, you know, in the fictional worlds, they all get found out, of course, by the Poirot or the Sherlock Holmes or what have you. And in fact, there are very few... For that reason, because we read detective novels, we're really reading about people attempting the perfect murder and being foiled by a detective figure that's smarter than they are. So,
of course, we wouldn't know about it.
And of course, in real life, right? I'm sure there's been all sorts of perfect murders done in real life, and I think that are hidden, you know, that we'll never know about because they're perfect. So that's the sort of funny thing, is that ultimately, I think out of all these 8 books, they're all essentially imperfect murders, in the sense that the someone figures them out.
Some of these books are also significant in being first, or, you know, significant steps on the sort of development of the genre, you know, the crime novel as well. The Red House Mystery, which is by A.A. Milne. I had no idea
did
anything other than Winnie the Pooh. But this is an early locked room mystery.
Yeah. And what's interesting about A.A. Milne is, you know, of course, Winnie the Pooh, but he wrote one murder mystery, and it was The Red House Mystery. And it's kind of a classic. In fact, actually, I was just in Waterstones today, and I saw it in a display area. It was a sort of a reissue, a classic reissue. And then he never wrote another one. And in fact, when you read it, it seems like he's kind of setting up for... you know, these two sort of amateur sleuths that are kind of in the P.G. Wodehouse mode. They're quite frothy, light, English young men characters that solve the crime. I always thought, having read this book years ago, I thought there was a really quite clever concealment in that one, in the sense that what happens is someone's killed and someone else disappears. And it's, if that happens, you automatically think that the person who's disappeared is the person who's done the killing and has taken off. And if that wasn't the case, if you could sort of conceal a murder within that. But yeah, it's an interesting book. It's actually a lot of fun. And it's got all sorts of sort of ridiculous locked room devices, including, I think, a priest hole and, hidden passages and all this sort of fun stuff. But, you know, they should actually... I wonder if there's ever been... I don't think there's been a film version. There probably was one in the 30s or something, but they should... they tried out these Agatha Christies, which are great. I love watching them, but there's other, you know, stuff they could do. They should do this one, so... It's my pitch for... I'll do it if anyone wants to ask me.
I want to talk about Double Indemnity. Now, I've read some other James M. Cain, but I've never actually read the book of this, even though I'm really pleased you included it, because it's one of my absolute top 5 favourite films.
Yeah, absolutely.
Amazing film.
I mean, again, this is a book I love. I'd say it's my favorite Cain. I also like The Postman Always Rings Twice, and I love this film as well. What's different, so the film, if you've only seen the film, the murder is quite similar, and it's made to look like the murdered husband. So it's an illicit affair, and they want to murder their husband. It's, you know, the story old as time there. He's made to look like he's fallen off the back of a train and broken his neck. So they do this sort of clever subterfuge where one of them pretends to be him on the train and goes to the back of the train, so there'll be witnesses that this man was on the train. It's a perfect murder in the sense of if it works, it's a perfect murder. It could go wrong in just so many ways, but it does naturally. But yeah, I always love that book. And the difference, if you haven't read the book yet, the book's quite plot-wise the same, but the book is quite, what's the word? It's quite savage, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's going to be lurid.
It's really lurid. And it's quite, and the ending of it is really quite shocking. That was sort of Kane's trademark. These sort of sickening sexual relationships that led toward murder. So
yeah,
there was limits to what
his rings twice.
Yeah, and the same thing in that book. And stuff that they couldn't quite get in the film versions of the 40s. Yeah.
It's just all done by that shot of that ankle bracelet as she walks down the stairs.
It's such a fun movie. It's such a terrific movie, yeah.
Strangers on the Train as well, you've included, by Patricia Highsmith. And in this case as well, I've only ever seen the Hitchcock movie. Great film, but again, I understand that the book is quite different.
Same thing, similar to the Kane. It's quite queasy and lurid. Because it's all about guilt. It's about, even though there's this proposed murder swap that, you know, I'll do your murder and you do mine. And if we're out of the country or whatever while it's being done, they won't be able to pin it on us. Of course, you got to find two people who want to do a murder. Mm-hmm. And again, I think as a perfect murders go, it's if everything went correct, it's smart. But, in some ways it's incredibly dumb because you've handed over this information to someone else.
Yeah, it's the sort of perfect and also the
stupidest
way of
murder. Yeah, a really dumb way. Yeah, all this stuff is in a way sort of referenced in the book as well. But it is a quite famous one. And of course because of the Hitchcock movie as well. But yeah, the book itself is terrific, but quite different feel.
And I wanted to say something about The Drowner. This is a John D. McDonald novel. I've read some of the Travis McGee novels because I happen to have a friend who's named after Travis McGee, and they're great. This just sounds insane.
Yeah, this one is quite insane. So John D. McDonald, and I'm not sure he was that popular in the UK, or maybe he was. And in fact, in the States right now, he's I'd say he's sort of out of fashion and kind of quite forgotten. But in mid-century America, I'd say that like just about every suburban dad had like the Travis McGee novels on their shelves. Which was his detective series, kind of a detective series. But he wrote about 50 standalones as well. And they range in quality, but the ones that are good are very good. And The Drowner is not one of his best books, but it has this sort of brilliant setup where there's this person finds a way to make it look like someone's drowned by sort of dragging them down beneath the surface from below. It's kind of creepy because if you think about it, it's sort of like a shark attack, but it's a human in scuba gear. And this sort of swampy pond in Florida, which no one would swim in anyway. But anyway, it does sound kind of ridiculous when you spell it out. But it's a book I read quite young, as had Malcolm. In fact, I will eventually read a section that has a little bit to do with this, but that affected me as a youth because if someone's found dead and drowning is a quite clever way to kill someone, I think. If you can, how can you prove that it wasn't just a simple drowning that they ran, unless they've been bashed on the head or something. So, I knew I had to get a John D. McDonald in there because he's kind of my, I do love his books and I am a completist. I've read them all and I've been reading them since I was quite young.
There's a couple of other novels, which I'm not going to go into in great detail, that also do what happens in The Drowner, which is, contriving some sort of accidental death as a murder. But the last one I wanted to talk about was The Secret History by Donna Tartt, which is the one I've read.
Yeah.
And I guess I want to talk about this because, as Malcolm mentions in the book, I thought this was a great, really realistic touch for someone who was a blogger, in that he says... had to put a contemporary novel, do you know, in a list, you know, you're writing this list of things for BuzzFeed or whatever, and you've got to put something that, like, people are going to identify with. And he chooses The Secret History. And I wanted to talk about, in doing that in reality, in choosing that one as the contemporary novel to put into this list, how hard was that to come up with? Because, you know,
it was a little bit hard. I was actually trying to think of recent books that had, like, a more well-known recent book, because I did think about composing that list as Malcolm would have thought about composing the list. In fact, in the book, it's his first book post, and he takes it quite seriously. And you do want a range. I mean, you want a couple golden age, you want a couple mid-centuries, probably a couple contemporaries. I really only have the one. But I think I thought of a lot of my favorite contemporary thrillers, and none of them had what the element of a perfect murder. And then I remembered Secret History, that when the students in the book decide to kill off their fellow student, this is not a spoiler because, in fact, it's in the first sentence of the book that they had killed Bunny. There's a bit where they think about what would make it look natural, and Bunny goes on these long walks in the woods, and they sort of wait for him in a spot, but they don't know if he's going to turn up or not. So in a way, they don't contrive. There's no advance of meet us there, and he'd tell someone. He just randomly runs into them, and that is the place of his death. And if he hadn't randomly, in a way, he picked his own death.
Yeah, that's how they contrive it. That he's chosen his own place.
I mean, but so I did remember that, and I've always loved this book, and so that became my sort of contemporary pick for the list.
I also liked how Malcolm, as well, he has actually, it turns out, many emotional reasons for not wanting to read too much crime fiction anymore. But he does make a point of saying, you know, as this person who runs a bookshop, he has to regularly recommend crime fiction to his customers, but he hasn't read them.
Yeah.
But he knows enough to say...
He stopped writing crime fiction for the... That's one of the early things you find out about him, is that he stopped reading crime fiction for several years,
But he knows enough to be able to, you know, say a couple of sentences from the press release or whatever. And I wondered now, as, you know, as somebody who is, you know, very firmly a crime fiction writer, multiple novels, to what extent you're still engaged with contemporary crime fiction?
I'm sort of more, I'm more engaged with contemporary crime fiction than I ever have been, in the sense that, for one thing, I mean, crime fiction writers are now my colleagues, and I meet them in places, and I want to read their books. Sometimes I'm on a panel with them, and it's nice to be able to have read one of their books and know that. There's blurbing, of course. But just knowing what's happening out there in the crime fiction world. But it goes against me. I mean, left to my own devices, I oddly am only drawn toward the old books. I don't know what it is. I mean, I also have this feeling like if something comes out this year and it's the buzzed about book, well, if I wait 20 years and people are still talking about it, then I'll know that it made it, and I'll read it then. I mean, I'll read it when it becomes the true classic as opposed to the instant classic, because there's no such thing. And so I don't know. I'm just drawn toward older books. I like the feel of reading something written a while ago. I mean, occasionally a book comes along, and I just feel like, I need to read that one because it's appealing to me. But yeah, so I do. I read across the spectrum. But
to finish off, then, can I get you to read us a bit?
Yeah. So I don't really need to set it up much because we've kind of set it up nicely. And in fact, some of the things we've talked about are going to be in this section. But one of the things that Malcolm does after being approached by Gwen, the FBI agent, to find out if he knows anyone who might have committed these crimes or has any information, he also delves back into the books on the list, trying to sort of think more about them and what, you know, clearly the killers read these books as well, so he wants to kind of get into his head. So this is a section of him at home talking about, really, the act of reading. I was beginning to fall asleep on the sofa, so I got up, rinsed out the beer bottles, threw away the remainder of my sandwich, brushed my teeth, and changed into my pajamas. Then I went to my bookshelf and found the book I was looking for, The Drowner. I had the original gold medal paperback, printed in 1963. It had one of those lurid, illustrated covers that adorn pretty much all of John D. MacDonald's mid-century paperbacks. On this one, a dark-haired woman in a white bikini is being pulled down through the murky green depths by a pair of hands gripping one of her pretty legs. It promised, like all these covers, two things, sex and death. I ran my thumb along the edge of the book, riffling the pages, and that musty, prickly smell of an old paperback reached my nostrils. I've always loved that smell, even though the book collector side of me knows that it was a sign of a book that has been improperly maintained over the years, a book that had probably sat in a cardboard box on the floor of a damp cellar for too many seasons. I brought the drowner into bed with me. I read the first paragraph, its words hauntingly familiar. Books are time travel. True readers all know this. But books don't just take you back to the time in which they were written. They can take you back to different versions of yourself. The last time I'd cracked this particular paperback, I was probably 11 or 12. I like to think it was summertime and I was up late in my cramped bedroom under a single sheet, a mosquito probably whining in one of the corners of the room. My father was playing his records in the living room, too loudly, depending on how drunk he was. Most nights ended the same, with my mother turning down his music, jazz usually, although sometimes he'd listen to fusion stuff like Frank Zappa or Weather Report, and my father berating her for not understanding him. But this was simply background noise, because I wasn't really there in that bedroom. I was actually in Florida in 1963, hanging out with shady real estate developers and sexy divorcees and drinking bourbon highballs. And now here I was again, almost 40 years old, and my eyes were running over the same words holding the same book I held 28 years ago, the same book some businessman or housewife held 50 years ago. Time travel.
So I've been talking to Peter Swanson. We've been talking about his latest novel, Rules for Perfect Murders, which is out now in the UK from Faber. Peter, thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.